Today is Friday, the 22nd day of December, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, the results are in for Catalonia's regional election. So, what's next?
So really, we're back to square one, to political stalemate, and the way forward is most certainly unclear.
Also ahead, will Chinese companies take advantage of the new U.S. tax laws? And we take a look at holiday movies. It's all ahead on today's International Edition. Election results are in from Spain's Catalonia region, and pro-independence parties have won an absolute majority, dealing a blow to the Spanish government. Now on the phone with me is reporter Henry Ridgewell to break down the latest. So Henry, pro-independence parties have managed to keep a majority in the regional parliament, but can you explain, like, how close was this vote, and does the new distribution, you know, make it significantly different than what there was before Madrid dissolved parliament?
The result was close in the end, in that the pro-independence parties, the three of them together, have retained their absolute majority by a margin of two seats within the parliament. So that explains the celebrations on the part of the pro-independence parties last night and through today. While the makeup of the parliament has changed somewhat, the actual balance between the pro-independence parties and those parties which favour sticking with Spain hasn't changed much at all. The only change really is on the other side, on the pro-unity side, where the party of the Prime Minister, Mariano Rajoy, the popular party, lost a lot of votes, probably, we think, because Catalans weren't happy with the way the Spanish government dealt with the crisis. So they then punished the Prime Minister's party. The biggest party on the night was, in fact, the pro-unity party, a relatively new party, only about a decade old, called Ciudadanos, who gained 37 seats in parliament, but not enough to form a government. So if you boil all that down, it means that not much has changed. Really, we're back to square one, to political stalemate, and the way forward is most certainly unclear at the moment.
So speaking of independence, Carlos Puigdemont, who fled to Belgium in October because he was wanted for arrest, what's been his reaction after the vote?
Well, he said the result was clear and the pro-independence parties have won, and he spoke as he claimed to be still the president of Catalonia despite his sacking by the Spanish government. And he says he pledged to come back to Barcelona and to lead the region again and to lead the region towards independence. And he has proposed this morning a meeting between himself and the Spanish Prime Minister, Mariano Rajoy, outside of Spain. Because, of course, as you say, Carles Puigdemont is still in exile in Belgium. He's still charged with rebellion and sedition. And if he was to try to return to Catalonia and Spain, it was very likely that he would be arrested upon his return.
Speaking of talks, Spanish Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy recently spoke to reporters about the election. What was his message?
Well, he had a tough response to the offer from Carles Puigdemont. The Prime Minister said that, in fact, well, it was his duty to ask the winner of the election, which was the pro-unity Spanish party, Ciudadanos, to ask them for talks, first of all. So effectively putting the ball back in the independence court. And I think what's clear now is that there is going to be escalating tension, escalating arguments between the independent side, probably led by Carles Puigdemont in exile, and the Prime Minister, Mariano Rajoy, who said that he could not possibly allow a government that would break the constitution in the future. So effectively ruling out any possible coalition government here in Catalonia that might suggest that it will make a bid for independence again, that might repeat the steps that we saw in October earlier this year. But neither side here showing any sign of willing to negotiate with the other.
Henry Ridgewell is following the story from Barcelona. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks very much.
And now joining me in the studio is VOA social media correspondent Andrew Palczewski. thanks you for stopping by on this Friday.
Yeah, good to be here, Steve.
Yeah, so what's going on online?
Well, big news out of the social media world. Facebook, which of course is the world's largest social network, has announced that they have signed a deal with Universal Music, which is the world's largest music label. So in the near term, what this means for everybody out there is that if you upload a video that uses music owned by Universal, you won't receive a copyright violation as you currently do. That's happened to lots of people I know. Will put up a video that has background music and they get a notice that says, you got to take it down.
Well, that was one of the biggest lawsuits filed against YouTube back in the day with copyright music and video for that matter.
Yeah, so this has major copyright implications. And in the long term, there's a lot of speculation that this could position Facebook to get into the music business, either as a streaming service
or... they're trying to get that audio playing across platforms now. It's available on Android, and there's some problems rolling out with iOS devices. But yeah, they're trying to do audio as well as video.
Yeah, they've talked about doing video production, so maybe they're going to be some Facebook music stars. We'll have to see. But this story, the next story, Steve, is one that especially for you.
Okay.
It's Tea Terrace is a cafe in London, and it's giving people who love coffee and social media, like yourself, a chance to combine their two loves with something they call the Selfie Chino. When you order a coffee using the cafe's app, you can upload a picture, and 4 minutes and $7.50 later, your picture is printed onto the foam on top of your beverage using a special machine called a Chino, which prints the photo using special flavorless food dye.
I think I'd be spending a lot of money there just because I like taking pictures, and I don't know if I'd want that to drink, but I certainly would want to do it and then take pictures of it.
Oh, yeah, and a lot of people have done just that because it's only been out a week, and so far only over 400 have been sold, so it's getting a lot of attention and a lot of purchase there in London.
That's amazing. Well, you know, sadly, we have to say goodbye to you. This is your last day here at VOA and International Edition.
It is. It's my last show at VOA. I've taken a new job in the new year, new opportunities, new beginnings. But I will be very sad to leave all of our listeners out there for International Edition. It's been a pleasure over the past few years to chat with you every day about social media.
Well, Andrew Palczewski, we certainly do wish you the best. And thank you for everything you've brought here. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Steve.
Here are some additional stories around the globe. South Sudan's government and armed groups signed a ceasefire agreement. It takes effect Saturday and will end hostilities, freeze military positions, and release prisoners of war, political detainees, and abducted women and children. South Korea has launched an investigation into a fire that killed 29 people in the central city of Jecheon. And U.S. President Donald Trump signed a $1.5 trillion tax overhaul into law Friday to cement the first major legislative win of his first year in office. For in-depth coverage to these stories and more, 24 hours a day, point your web browser to voanews.com. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
If you're a former smoker and would like to help your lungs, a new study from scientists at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health suggests that you eat more fruit, especially tomatoes and apples. The study, published in the European Respiratory Journal, finds over a 10-year period, ex-smokers who ate a diet high in tomatoes and fruits had a slower natural decline in lung function. Researchers suggest that there are certain elements in the fruit that could be helping to repair the damaged lungs of former smokers. The findings are based on data gathered by the Aging Lungs in European Cohorts study. Oh, and if you think eating more pizza, spaghetti, or other dishes made with processed tomatoes and fruit will do the trick, the researchers say, sorry, the restorative effect only works with fresh fruit products. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
From the Voice of America, this is International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. Chinese companies with international ambitions have been caught in a serious dilemma by the U.S. move to cut corporate taxes. The move has made the United States an attractive destination for Chinese companies facing very high taxes and other restrictions at home. But as Miller Sega explains, on the other hand, they face the risk of being punished by Chinese authorities who are opposed to unnecessarily overseas investments.
Earlier this week, China wrapped up a top-level annual economic policymaking conference with a three-year pledge to fight financial risks. Though there was no specific mention of the U.S. tax reform, it was clear that Chinese authorities are gearing up to counter any external risks to the domestic economy. Beijing gave a demonstration of its determination in this area Tuesday as Chinese police broke up an underground bank in Guangdong. The bank was suspected of involvement in cross-border transactions worth over $70 million in the past month alone. Chinese companies and wealthy individuals are known to use underground banks to move funds abroad when breaching Beijing's strict controls on investing in areas the government does not want to encourage. Chinese investors worry both about official disapproval at home as well as a possibility the Trump administration might take new measures to curb foreign investments in the U.S. Jacob Kirkgaard, a fellow in the Washington-based Peterson Institute of International Economics, said it's important to look at how Chinese investors and Chinese firms view this U.S. tax move.
So perhaps they view this as an opportunity, and that more Chinese firms will then look to invest in the United States. But keep in mind that the Trump administration is also, at the same time, going through a significant, potentially significant tightening of the foreign investment rules, the CFIUS process, which will clearly make it more difficult for many Chinese firms to at least take over or buy American companies.
Despite the challenges, China-based multinational companies and wealthy individuals cannot ignore the fact that recent moves by the Trump administration are going to change the investment scenario in the U.S. and have some impact in other markets as well.
I think the bigger concern for China, rather than direct, is that it's moving to make U.S. corporations more competitive.
That's Christopher Balding, Associate Professor of Finance at Beijing University.
China is very well aware that it is no longer the dominant, it is no longer the low-cost producer anywhere in the world.
Balding says some in China think that U.S. firms are going to pull their profits out of China and repatriate to the U.S., but
I personally think that's a relatively unfounded fear.
For reporter Saibal Dasgupta, I'm Millar Sega, VOA News.
The United Nations Security Council will vote on another round of targeted sanctions aimed at imposing even stricter restrictions on North Korea's crude oil imports, which fuel its illicit weapons programs. This time in response to Pyongyang's November 28th launch of a newly developed intercontinental ballistic missile called the Hwasong-15 that North Korea claims is capable of delivering nuclear warheads anywhere in the continental United States. Joining me on the phone is Harry Kazianis, Director of Defense Studies at the Center for the National Interest. So, Harry, this is the third time the Security Council is voting on North Korean sanctions this year, kind of aiming to getting Pyongyang to the negotiating table. Is the third time the charm?
No, the North Koreans are not going to come to the negotiating table until they feel they have a viable nuclear deterrent. What that means in plain-spoken English, the ability to hit the United States with a nuclear weapon.
Haven't they demonstrated that with the Hwasong-15 missile launch?
Nobody really knows, to be honest with you. Depending on what expert you believe, what analysis from the U.S. government you're reading at the time, I don't think anybody really knows. The trick here with this is, does the reentry vehicle, in other words, when the warhead goes into the atmosphere and comes down, can it withstand all the atmospheric reentry pressures and hit a target down on the ground, essentially? And there are some reports in places like The Diplomat that say the North Koreans have that capability. The U.S. government, South Korean intelligence, they say no. So it really depends on who you believe. The North Koreans, though, have put out footage and photos of them doing different tests on the reentry vehicles to see if it can withstand atmospheric reentry. I think they're at least very, very close, if not there. So now I think the next thing the North Koreans are going to do is a full-up ICBM test, not necessarily with a nuclear weapon attached, but to necessarily show the full range and to show that warhead basically coming through the atmosphere and dropping into the South Pacific. I think that's where we're going next.
But another round of sanctions isn't going to prevent that.
No, absolutely not.
One other question. North Korea continues to be linked to cyber attacks. We think about the Sony Picture hack and, of course, the Swift Banking Network attack. Those are some of the high-profile cases. But they're also dabbling in cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin. Are sanctions against Pyongyang just moving North Korea into new sectors to get around the blocks put up by the UN?
Yes, quite simply. The North Koreans, as their conventional means of making money and even unconventional illegal means of making money, in the non-cyber realm are starting to dry up. They're going to have to move into online, functions much more rigorously. In 2018, I wouldn't be shocked if you see a lot of North Korean cyber warriors in places like India, Pakistan, China, all over the world, essentially going out and attacking Bitcoin exchanges, using malware and different types of viruses to try and basically make as much money as they can by, finding Windows exploits and hacking into people's computers and just trying to get as much money for the regime as possible. They're going to have to do that, especially if new sanctions are passed within the next few days. They're really going to have to do everything they possibly can to make sure that the regime has the money that it needs to continue funding its nuclear missile programs. Keep in mind, the North Korean dictatorship doesn't care about the people. They'll let the people starve. Their goal is to make sure that nuclear program keeps running.
Harry Kazianis is the Director of Defense Studies at the Center for the National Interest. Happy holidays, and thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
This is VOA.
Hi, this is Lori London. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts. Every hour, on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong.
You love music?
How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood?
Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
This is International Edition. Every year around the holidays, there is a spike in the viewership of classic Christmas movies, and VOA's Penelope Pulu spoke with Todd Hitchcock, Associate Director of the American Film Institute's Silver Theater and Cultural Center, about landmark Christmas films and what makes a movie classic.
To my big brother George, the richest man in town.
Frank Capra's 1947 movie classic, It's a Wonderful Life, tells the story of George Bailey, a generous man driven to bankruptcy. When George wishes he was never born, Clarence, an angel, comes to Earth and fulfills his wish to show him how dreary and sad life would have been for the townsfolk of Bedford Falls without him. George realizes how precious life is, and Clarence returns him to his friends and family. They all pull together and bail him out. Clarence succeeds in his mission and finally gets his wings.
Look, Daddy, teacher says every time a bell rings, an angel gets his wings.
Todd Hitchcock, assistant director of the AFI Silver Theater and Cultural Center in Silver Spring, Maryland, says when the film was first released, it did not do well in the theaters, but it saw a revival through yearly television broadcasts during an era where there were only three TV networks and about 30 million people were tuning in.
By the time that my generation comes around in the 70s and 80s, it's grown year by year into this institution, this traditional screening that you watch it at least once in the lead up to Christmas with your family. And now it's just taken for granted that it's this established Christmas classic.
Nostalgia is part of the tradition for a movie classic, but one should not underestimate the staying power and message of such films. An example is Miracle on 34th Street by George Seaton, another 40s favorite, where the real Santa Claus takes a job at a department store in New York City, trying to remind the manager of the store, a single mother, that Christmas is more than just gifts and spending.
Oh, Christmas isn't just a day. It's a frame of mind. And that's what's been changing.
So much of it of the film's about anxiety on the part of Christmas is too commercialized and the stress and the pressure of the gift giving.
The stress from Christmas commercialization is also the theme of later films, such as the 1960s animated TV production A Charlie Brown Christmas, which became so popular it joined the pantheon of Christmas classics.
The viewership is huge and it remains consistent year to year. One generation grows up on it, they have children, the next generation grows up on it.
In 1983, another classic was born. Set in the 1940s, Bob Clark's comedy, A Christmas Story, tells the story of Ralphie, who tries to convince his parents and Santa that a Red Ryder BB gun really is the perfect Christmas gift.
That film directly engages with nostalgia and then sort of gently tweaks it. There's a lot of 80s comedy sensibility woven into that look at this sepia-toned 40s, 50s growing up period. And it works fantastically well in A Christmas Story. And as you know, it has become just as much of an institution.
You'll shoot your eye out, kid. Merry Christmas.
Hitchcock says curating these films in art theaters, such as AFI Silver, is one of the ways to safeguard their staying power, starting with It's a Wonderful Life.
Attaboy, Clarence.
And holidays, Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
And that's going to do it for today's show. Thank you so much to Patrice Martin for directing this episode, as well as Skip Sisk for engineering the broadcast. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great weekend and happy holidays.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
When President Donald Trump introduced his administration's comprehensive policy toward Iran earlier this year, he urged U.S. allies to join the United States in taking strong action to counter the regime's support for terrorist proxies and destabilizing activities in the region. Physical remnants from those activities went on display in Washington recently, when U.S. Permanent Representative to the United Nations Nikki Haley stood before recovered military debris in a warehouse in Washington. Ambassador Haley said the display showed concrete evidence of illegal Iranian weapons proliferation gathered from direct military attacks on our partners in the Middle East.
Behind me is an example of one of these attacks. These are the recovered pieces of a missile fired by Houthi militants. It was made in Iran, then sent to Houthi militants in Yemen. From there, it was fired at a civilian airport with the potential to kill hundreds of innocent civilians in Saudi Arabia.
The warehouse also contained recovered material from an anti-tank guided missile, an unmanned aerial vehicle known as a kamikaze drone, and material from an explosive boat that contains a warhead that detonates on impact.
All of these weapons include parts made in Iran, some by Iran's government-run defense industry. All are proof that Iran has defied the international community. And not just one time. This evidence demonstrates a pattern of behavior in which Iran sows conflict and extremism in direct violation of UN Security Council resolutions.
The evidence is undeniable, Ambassador Haley declared. The weapons might as well have had "Made in Iran" stickers all over it. Iran, she said, is determined to undermine the international consensus against its conduct. We must speak with one voice in exposing the regime for what it is, a threat to the peace and security of the entire world. We call on all nations to join us in a united front resisting this global threat.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.